You are listening to the Unsettling Knowledge Inequities podcast presented by the Knowledge Equity Lab and Spark, the Scholarly Publishing and Academic Resources Coalition. Hello and welcome back to our third season. My name is Safa and I'm your host. This season, we continue our goal of interrogating the politics of knowledge production, exchange, and circulation, but with a special focus on exploring the implications of the widespread and often uncritical use of artificial intelligence and machine learning technologies. In particular, we will examine how the use of these technologies by corporate publishers and data analytics companies can replicate and exacerbate existing structural and other forms of inequities in societies and in academia. We will be in conversation with folks committed to bringing awareness to and challenging the potential impacts of these technologies, particularly on the equitable production, discovery, and circulation of knowledge in academia and beyond. In our first episode, we are joined by colleagues from the Distributed AI Research Institute, also referred to as DARE. DARE is an interdisciplinary and globally distributed organization rooted in the belief that AI is not inevitable, its harms are preventable, and when its production and deployment include more diverse perspectives and more deliberate processes, it can be beneficial.
I am Dylan Baker. I'm an engineer and researcher at DARE, and I'm based in Seattle, Washington.
And I am Milagros Micheli. I am based in Berlin, Germany, but I originally come from Argentina. And I am a research fellow at DARE and a researcher at the Weizmann Institute in Berlin.
My name is Alex Hanna. I am the director of research at the Distributed AI Research Institute. I am actually trained as a sociologist, and that's what my PhD is in. And my undergrad degrees are in computer science, math, and sociology. So I was working with computer science methods. And then as I finished my computer science degree, I was learning more about social media tools, especially being used in activism. And so I was interested in understanding how we could kind of make sense of a lot of social media content online. In my sociology program, I started working with machine learning, particularly to do things like classify text on social media, and was interested in things like how activists were using social media. And so have some work that was classifying some Facebook posts that some activists in Egypt were posting to organize, and then developed a tool for my dissertation, which was called the Machine Learning Protest Event Data System, which was generating data on news articles to determine if people were protesting or not, and if the newspaper article is mentioning it. And so once after I graduated and was first at the University of Toronto and then went to Google and was getting more interested in basically the ways in which these things were exacerbating existing inequalities, the ways that they were built in, and taking existing inequalities, be those racial or gender or between the Global North and Global South, and making them worse, and how AI was supercharging that. And I mean, AI is this term that's quite old and is sort of a term that's been thrown on a number of technologies that have been around for a while. So AI or machine learning. And so I was pretty interested in that and found the ethical AI team at Google. Dylan and I used to be part of this team at Google. This is a team that was co-founded by Meg Mitchell and Timnit Jabrew. But after both of them wrote a paper about large language models, this particular type of technology, there was a call internally for them to retract their names for the paper, and they refused. And Timnit was fired because of it. And then Meg was fired because she was defending Timnit effectively. But the team itself was and still is oriented towards understanding the harms that come out of AI technologies and methods of mitigating those harms. And so, Dylan, you can say more, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, that covers it in my experience. Yeah, a really, really wonderful group of people, and definitely one of the most accepting and supportive and collaborative work environments that I've been in, especially at Google. I think the culture of the team was super unique and really, really special, and something that I think Timneat is really building back up again at DARE. So as an undergrad, I focused my degree around like data science and machine learning, and I read Weapons of Math Destruction in an AI class that I think really helped to crystallize a lot of the like thoughts that I was having around ethics in machine learning and in the sciences. And actually before that, my dad is a conspiracy theorist who was sort of radicalized on YouTube and like Wikipedia. So I was sort of raised from a really young age, like extremely online and extremely online in these very sort of radical spaces. It was a really weird way to grow up with a relationship to like information and misinformation. But I think that having that relationship to internet content from as early as I can remember interacting with computers, I think fueled a lot of how I see ethics in AI and ML and technology in general. But yeah, after undergrad, I ended up at Google. I was doing like experimental machine learning projects and a lot of the data infrastructure. So I think like I was primed to expect the like model training aspect of ML and didn't really have a complete picture of the 90% of work that goes on behind the scenes to make model training possible. And I think getting firsthand experience doing that and also being in conversations with ML practitioners and like how these experimental products came to be and the kinds of motivations and the voices in these conversations, I think was really eye-opening to me. And it felt like there were so many disconnects between all of the different sides of the ethical concerns that were going on, that I think it just pushed me even more to want to be working on not only working in like ethical AI, but also working on finding ways to communicate across disciplines and between different like communities of practice and ways of thinking about these problems and parts of this massive system that creates machine learning models and products and production material. And so at DARE, part of my work is in helping with engineering things on research projects. And part of it is trying to move in a direction of finding ways to communicate our research to the public and communicate between a bunch of different stakeholders and disciplines and finding ways to make this accessible and like find the people that it actually needs to reach and reach them in a meaningful way. And in between those things, I was on the ethical AI team.
Yeah. And how did I get here? So I am a sociologist like Alex. I am trained as a sociologist. And as a sociologist, I was doing a lot of projects at university that had to do with inequality, with power, also with knowledge production, but nothing really related to technology. And I had never worked in technology. And I actually, besides these projects that were part of my degree in sociology, I had never really worked in research. But this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to work in research. So I found a job to be a research assistant as I was still writing my master thesis at the Weizmann Institute for a group that was totally about AI, a group only with computer scientists. So they were not other social scientists in the group. And I applied. I thought, okay, I will be brave and I will apply. And for some reason, I will never know why, they hired me. And I started working with them. At first, I was really lost and I had to really catch up because I had never thought of artificial intelligence in any capacity. So I had to read a lot. I had to catch up. But then at one point, I realized that some of the problems that are caused or enhanced by AI are actually problems that we sociologists have been discussing in other forms and in other places and contexts. So I thought, okay, this is not that different from that I have been working on before. It's just the tech element that is challenging to me because I don't have a technical background. So yeah, I started working on that and I realized that there is a space and there is also a need to apply this knowledge about power and this framing about power and the framing of how knowledge is produced through and with AI and with data also. And this is what I started doing. I started thinking also of classification, which is something that sociologists have thought about for long, and thinking of how this is done in AI production and through AI later. And this is how I started working with data annotators because I thought, okay, this is really the moment where the classification happens. Later, I realized that there are many moments where classification happens. But to me, it was like the first instance where I thought, okay, this is very obvious a case where I could think through the framing of classification. And I started with working with data laborers, did field work with them. And yeah, this is how I got here.
Yeah. So the way that I think about it in like the simplest possible terms is that classification is never a neutral thing to be doing, that creating ways to break down our world into simpler pieces and create these concepts and classificatory categories is a very human thing and involves making lots of simplifications and assumptions, because that's how we boil things down into smaller numbers of properties. And in all of those simplifications and assumptions, we're making a lot of decisions about how we're going to frame the world. And that in and of itself propagates out these worldviews and then creates the world that we're in and propagates out more simplifications and assumptions that people make. And so it has a way of reinforcing itself. And if we're not thoughtful and careful about how we choose to classify things and like design these classification systems, we can end up just reproducing the same kinds of systems of power that exist and make things bad now. And so by default, that's generally what happens. And so we see the same kinds of issues that you see in the larger world play out in different ways on smaller scales within machine learning systems. A lot of the questions about data labor that we have, or the problems that we see in data labor, are similar problems that we see in all different types of labor. And I think that's like one of the points that we're trying to get across in general, is that a lot of these problems are not new. Like all of these flashy and exciting things that people are building can't get us away from the fundamental issues of power that we're facing just societally.
And Dylan, like, I love this example that you've done. I talked about this in a class the other day, but you took this image of Seattle, and I'd love for you to describe it for the podcast, because I think it was a really interesting way of talking about it.
Yeah. So an image that I used in this explorable article was just a picture of the Seattle skyline. And you can think about how you might classify or like separate out all the objects in that image. And in one version of this, you see like the Space Needle, and that's annotated as a landmark. And you see a bunch of different buildings, and one of them is labeled like a non-residential building, and another one is a residential building. And then you see a box around a tree that just says tree, and a box around Mount Rainier that says mountain. And that seems like a really objective way to just like separate out objects from the scene. But you can also think about a totally different worldview that would be communicated if the objects that you pulled out were different and labeled differently. So in another example, instead of classifying buildings as, for example, residential or non-residential, you could classify structures as like religious or non-religious or unknown, like spiritual value. So in this picture, I have the Space Needle box and it says structure of unknown religion, and a box around an office building that says non-religious structure. There also, instead of just a box around a tree, could be like a box around the same tree that's labeled non-medicinal plant, and a box around some shrubs elsewhere that weren't even highlighted in the first image that's labeled a plant that's edible when cooked. Like Mount Rainier, in this case, is labeled Tahoma, which was the original name of the mountain from the people who were indigenous to the area. There's also a picture of a few tents, like a small campsite in front of some of the shrubs that was not labeled in the original picture. That's just sort of part of the backdrop. And in the second image, it's labeled campsite and community. So the way that we decide to break down something as simple as just a picture of the Seattle skyline can communicate really fundamentally different worldviews about what it is we see and how we classify and categorize them. And then like what's important to surface, and opens up different questions about what we think about a space, what we think the space is for.
Part of understanding how artificial intelligence and machine learning algorithms and models produce knowledge is tracing how they have been trained and developed, and who has had the power or epistemic authority to decide what gets labeled and classified, in what way, based on what value systems.
At the very, very low level, like as a very junior engineer being in spaces where machine learning researchers are making low-level decisions about how to classify things in practice, and just in my personal experience, a lot of the time it seemed like people were very uncomfortable making explicit their underlying assumptions when thinking about how to make classifications. So for example, there were a lot of projects where we wanted to classify, it was an automatic photography, and we wanted to classify images as like really subjective things, like is sentimental, is scenic, is a heartwarming moment or image of people. Like sometimes it would get down to like, okay, well, we can classify hugging, we can classify high-fiving, we can classify kissing, we can classify jumping. We have classifiers that we sort of quote-unquote believe to work with some amount of accuracy. So let's say that like sentimental is somebody maybe hugging or kissing or two people jumping together. And so these things like arise out of practicality, but I witnessed like zero discussions about not even just like the subjective nature of, you know, what makes something scenic, but these were just built off of like, we decided to create these models because unclear someone's PhD was in this space. And like, you see all the sort of threads of like, why did we build this model to detect this thing? Well, there are some like low level sort of technical reasons why it was like easy to put these two types of models together. And this architecture happened to work really well for like finding two people and positioning their heads and finding them close together. So now we can classify kissing. And now we have this project where we want to find sentimental moments. And so, you know, all these things are sort of glued together. And then when we get to the part that I was working on, which was data labeling, where I'm trying to find panels of 10 or 20 or 100 people to label hundreds of thousands of these video clips as sentimental or scenic, it feels almost meaningless to have a conversation when I try to bring up like, this is a really subjective thing. Do we know anything about the data labelers or their worldviews or like how they might feel about these kinds of things? Because that was never a reason any of this was built. That was never part of that conversation because it didn't incorporate into how people were thinking about these things or the motivations behind building them. And so at that point, it almost didn't make sense to address those questions at the very lowest level stage, which was the data labeling, which is going to build the ground truth, which is going to tell us, quote unquote, like how well these models are performing, which is going to inform the gold standard for the product that people actually get. And it was really frustrating and interesting to witness firsthand. And I think was a big part of the reason that I wanted to move into ethics in the first place was because like, it was fundamentally incompatible with the way that things were built to have conversations that needed to happen for any of these products to make any sense.
Yeah, maybe I can add, I found really interesting what Dylan was just saying, because yeah, it shows more like the side of how requesters come to put together the idea of how things should be labeled. And this mention about how requesters sometimes don't even ask themselves, where are these laborers? What's their cultural background? Is this going to make sense to them? And so on. And I can maybe talk about the other side of things, namely the laborers that are outsourced somewhere. I work with groups in Argentina and Latin America. Also with my collaborator, Julian Posada, we also did a study on data annotators in Venezuela. And also I did field work in Bulgaria with refugees from the Middle East who were doing this kind of work. And first to the question, who decides, who has the power to decide, right? This is very clearly a very hierarchical structure. So the one who decides is the one who has the money to pay for these annotations to be done in a certain way, in a very specific way, to what Dylan was already commenting before. And then there is the question of the epistemic authority, right? Like, so there is this belief or this naturalization of the authority of managers or this authority of, you know, those who are a little bit higher in this hierarchy might know better or might have the right answer when answers come up. So the data laborers would typically trust the judgment of the managers. And if the managers don't know what to do, they would go to the client and ask. Now, the interesting thing is that in all this process and structure, I have never witnessed labelers discussing among themselves to actually decide how to label, let's say, an image in a better way. What would make sense to them? What, you know, like they would be confronted with satellite imagery and they would not discuss among themselves, okay, what do you think? Is this a tree? Or can we use other type of labels? Can we do this differently? But the discussion would always center around the client. What would the client expect? What does he want? What do they want? So I think that shows how these things is done and how this myth of consensus, you know, the wisdom of the crowd is actually a myth, because in the end, these people just are worried to keep their jobs. They are subject to this very, you know, like top-down form of imposition. And really, like the structure in which they work doesn't leave them much room or much agency for them to really, you know, use their subjectivity, use their logic to interpret data in a way. Even though they are, of course, they are totally capable of doing this, and probably it would be a better way, and we would be creating or producing way better data if we would do this. But this doesn't happen. And maybe one more thing to add to this is that we were discussing before the question of how classification creates truth and how classification imposes a certain worldview, a specific worldview. I think this is a very important part of my work. I think that's the question of naturalization, how we, in many occasions, we just classify something and we think that this is obvious and we think that this is, yeah, the way things naturally are. And it might be that for a certain group of people who think alike, this might look obvious. But this doesn't mean that this is obvious for everyone or that that classification works for everyone.
Absolutely. So if we think about this point that Mila just said about the way that these things get naturalized, you can think about kind of the ways in which these data sets or the data sets that are used are often classifying things in a particular way. So for instance, there was some research that came out of Facebook where they took a data set called the Dollar Street data set. And this data set has images of people and their households all around the world. And they also have the income, the monthly income of those households. And then they trained several different computer vision algorithms that were intended to do what's called image classification, basically, or object classification. They say what's in the image. And so then what they ended up doing is that once they trained these on three major algorithms, one's called ImageNet, one's called Open Images, the other's called MS Coco. And these data sets are gathered and developed by labs or universities, primarily in the West. And they went ahead and analyzed, you know, how well does this do in classifying? You know, they had a kind of a top line metric in which they classified, you know, how well did it this do on images from, you know, from the West versus from the global South. And as you'd expect, this did, you know, quite poorly on images from the global South. As an example, one I like to use is, you know, there's an image of soap from Nepal, in which the household income was something like 100 to 200 US dollars a month. And it was classified as food or cheese. And then when they did the same thing with an image from the UK, in which the income was 2000 US dollars a month, it was classified correctly or more closely. And so, you know, this has some pretty clear ramifications for that kind of exacerbation. You're sort of taking this thing that looks illegible in one context, or has been naturalized to be expected to look like this in one context, but is in fact looks like a completely different thing, or is recognized as a completely different thing. And in some other research that we did with two sociologists of science at University of California, Los Angeles, we were assessing how much these particular data sets were actually being used in machine learning research. So we actually found in terms of the subfield of computer vision. Actually, all across, there's an intense amount of concentration about how much these data sets are used, both for training and evaluation. And so only 12 data sets are used in 50% or more than 50% of the papers used in machine learning. All of those data sets, except for two, are developed in the US. One is developed in Germany, and then the other is developed in China, in Hong Kong. And so this has pretty big ramifications in terms of what becomes naturalized. And it has, you know, I think the analog is pretty common when we talk about this in computer vision. You know, what gets seen, what gets recognized as sort of natural. But we could also see very clear ways in which this is recognized in natural language processing, where the problem gets exacerbated, because now we have to introduce the problem of language. And there's a great rule that one of a kind of a friend of Dare and our team calls, it's called the Bender rule, named after Emily Bender, in which if there's a technology that's developed, she asks, okay, does it work just for English? And if you violated the Bender rule, you need to go back to the drawing board. And so we see the Bender rule happen, and that's just English. That's not even, you know, that's not even considering other types of primarily Western languages, including Spanish, French, Portuguese, etc. And then we see this get exacerbated as we get into, you know, if you're focused on, let's say, Arabic, is it just modern standard Arabic? Is it just Egyptian Arabic, which is the most spoken dialect, the one I recognize the most? Are we thinking about things like Sudanese Arabic, Moroccan Arabic, or things that could be more useful to a certain community of people? And as we are proceeding as other projects with there, we're actually focusing on other types of languages in which people who are being targeted in terms of the Tigray genocide, the languages that are spoken in the Horn of Africa and the types of languages there. So there's an immense amount of linguistic diversity in the world, but most of the NLP tools are focused mostly on English, unfortunately. And I mean, we already know that we already have an existing problem that the lingua franca of academia is English, right? This is already a huge problem, right? And so then that already has a particular sort of bias in terms of what can actually be published and who does get published. I would also say more generally from the perspective of knowledge finding and creation is sort of the ways in which the existing knowledge repositories then get compounded by the models then that are built on top of that. So for instance, the largest Wikipedia repository in the Wikipedia project is in English. English Wikipedia is the biggest. I think that's right. I'm kind of making that claim. I think the last time I checked, it was the largest one. It's followed by, I think, another Romance language, but then it sort of drops off very quickly. There's a paper I'm thinking of, I'll share. The main title of it is Do You Speak My Language? And it was focusing on repositories of different linguistic corpora. Now you can think about where tools get built on top of that. So for instance, the types of techniques that Timmy and Meg were writing about at Google, large language models. And you can think of large language models in a very simplified way. One of the things is that large language models should be thought of as sort of rewriting, you know, one text to another from a human language to kind of an internally recognized language. They do some kind of prediction to human language because they're generative models. But prior to do that, there's some steps in which they have to understand this in their neural network architecture. And so if most of that stuff is being trained on English language text, then those aren't going to be very successful. They're not going to do rewrites in a language that's going to be very helpful for people. And we already know that large language models already have these huge problems in which they write these things, rewrite these things in a very negative and violent way for certain groups as well, just in English too. We have people who have done audits of the purported training data of these large language models, like the Common Crawl database, and found out they had just all kinds of negative associations in there. like associated in Muslim with negative sentimentality or gender minority groups, etc. So there's sort of these dual problems of the data that's available and also the kind of methods that are built on top.
DARE's pioneering work on these issues is guided by a set of values and a research philosophy with a strong focus on collaborative and non-extractive approaches to knowledge production that prioritizes accountability to community and centers the expertise of collaborators from diverse backgrounds.
Part of the things that I'm doing at DARE is what will be the research philosophy. I'm doing this with Alex. Thinking of the research philosophy that we actually want to hold us accountable to, and thinking also in terms of whom else we want to be accountable to. So several of the things that we are thinking through have to do with how to approach communities. What does it mean to do work with communities? Who are the communities we want to work with? And in terms of how to avoid, of course, extractivist practices, how not to be, you know, the researcher that parachutes themselves into the field and does something, takes what they are going to take and then forget about the community. But rather, how to fund projects that are community-led, that emerge from certain communities. So, for example, one of the things that we are starting now is some sort of workers' inquiry, where we want to fund workers to do some sort of an account of their workplaces, with the researcher just being a facilitator in that setting and not being the researcher, the one who tells the story of the worker. So that's one of the things that we are thinking of. Maybe Alex wants to add about the other projects.
Yeah, for sure. Kind of thinking about projects in which workers are telling their own stories. And, you know, one person that we're working with, her name is Adrienne, and she's a former Amazon delivery driver and former charter school teacher and a labor organizer, and has a lot of experience in sort of in working and understanding the kind of connections in which how this work and how labor connects to these systems of AI and data extraction and algorithm management. You know, we're also working with a group focusing on a project that is focusing on hate speech and disinformation in the Horn of Africa, and working closely with a refugee advocate named Maron, who's done immense amounts of work in advocating for refugees from Eritrea, and working with many people who have encountered kind of horrific torture and after being taken hostage and being refugees, and encountering the sort of mis and disinformation that comes from governments and related and their kind of related allies and networks. So she has a deep knowledge of that. We also are working with many journalists and activists who've been targeted to understand that, and really approaching this from a kind of a, both a computational angle, but also knowing that that computational angle is really nothing unless we really have people who are really knowing and have been tracking this stuff for years on their own, just doing this in their spare time because they just have no recourse. And so this is something that we've been doing. And Dylan, I know you've been working very closely with those folks. If you wanted to say a bit more about that too.
Yeah, I think something that has been really unique or like super powerful about working at DARE is the shift of how expertise is thought of and valued. Because, yeah, I have been working really closely with the team of folks that Alex was describing. And a lot of my work is in like engineering support work. And so like I have lots of experience doing like large scale data pipelines and processing and management. And I think in like my former settings, both at school and internships and at Google, that's sort of where it ends. It's the model is very much parachuting. It's for somebody with the technical skills to jump into a new space, and sort of there's the savior complex of, you know, I have these incredible magical skills that nobody else could possibly have, and I'm going to apply them to your subject area and, you know, come up with some miraculous solution and give it to you and save the day, where it is like extremely clear that I lack any of the context and knowledge to begin with, where I'm standing to have any insight into how to do my work effectively. And so I'm very much guided by the folks on the ground who have been doing this kind of archiving work for years unpaid, and the folks who have been living their entire lives informed by the context of what's going on in Ethiopia and Eritrea and in the larger like diaspora communities. And I really value being able to be led by their expertise because it like makes my job so much more effective and allows me to actually feel like I can do meaningful work because I have the expertise available to me and I have the resources and we're able to work closely together. And so my skill set is useful. I think there are lots of other people in positions like mine without the infrastructural and institutional support to be able to defer to this kind of expertise in guiding their work. And like I know a lot of other people who feel frustrated and sort of helpless, and reasonably so, because it's really encouraged to take this kind of saviorist parachuting model, this really exceptionalist approach to this particular skill set, which I think is viewed that way for a variety of reasons, but through like an enormous amount of gatekeeping and, you know, all of the other things that are built into the institutions that gatekeep this kind of knowledge and skill acquisition, which is particularly ludicrous because it's one of the most achievable skill sets like on your own with the internet right now. And people still choose to gatekeep it. Anyway, that's sort of a tangent.
It's not a tangent at all, because it's sort of talking both about how you work with communities, right? Because I think there's definitely a model. There's the parachute model with both of you referred to, but there's also the model of like, we've written up this whole thing. Do you like what we did? And it's sort of an approval at the end, you know, and this is sort of often what happens at companies where there's like building of AI and they're like, oh, maybe we should make sure that it's not doing anything too racist or something. But then you sort of have to reject the premises on which it's built, you know? So, you know, if you came to me as a trans woman and you like, we're like, we built a gender classifier and we want to make sure it works on people who are dark skinned, and do you approve it? I'd go, well, no, I reject this. I reject the whole theory of this thing. Like, I don't think this should be a problem that should be approached. You know, I don't think that's, and I mean, you can think of many other similar things like facial recognition systems. Are you going to get community approval of a facial recognition system? Like, no, it's a carceral technology that should be rejected on the premises. And so, you know, building things and working with community means that starting from the stage of problem formulation and of, you know, do we even need this thing? Should we even frame this in this way? How is this going to be of any sort of benefit? And that means really starting with people and having people on staff that have those knowledges, and then having input at every kind of level of the pipeline in building machine learning technologies or, you know, approaching critiques of them.
Having listened to our conversation, you might be asking yourself, what are ways in which the companies building and using these AI and ML technologies can be held more accountable for the harms and inequities that they exacerbate?
Unfortunately, there's not a lot of like accountability mechanisms that occur in the world right now, especially for big corporations that have huge, immense amounts of capital and market capitalization, right? The kinds of existing, any legislative or regulatory domains, the sort of things that we have are sort of the sort of public relations sort of shaming that one can do. But different jurisdictions have different sorts of regulations that could be leveraged. So in Europe, there's the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, and there's going to be the AI Act that is looking to be, it's being discussed in the European Parliament now. I'm less familiar with the Canadian context since I left Canada, but in the US, there's a few kind of efforts, at least at some privacy accountability regulation, but there's really like not too many kinds of things that are actionable. And so one of the things that I think we can sort of start thinking about, or one of the kinds of roles of I think scholars and kind of, I think scholar activists, is to sort of say, well, what are ways in which there are kind of solidarities that can be built to sort of start working and calling out some of these things and kind of organizing against them, and what are kind of community-based strategies of doing that. And so there are kind of efforts that exist in sort of coalitions. Often these fights happening on like a municipal government level of, you know, stopping certain municipalities from adopting technologies like SpotShotter or Predpol. And there's an example that Lily Irani and Khaled Alexander talked about, in which they organized against the streetlights in San Diego, California. And they had some kind of scholar activists that would go and explore, and were reading, read the terms of service of these streetlights, and found out that, you know, GE, who I think produced them, was entitled to all the data that they collected. And so even if they wanted to stop using this, you know, GE still had all this data. And these smart streetlights have video and audio capture in them. Actually, I think they had audio capture. I'm not sure if they had video. And so these are sort of these like battles that are happening at a really, you know, these municipal, these city-based levels, but these are immensely consequential. Yeah, and I'd love to hear Mila and Dylan what y'all think about this too.
In general, I think that the thing that we can do is empower ourselves and other. And how we do that is through knowledge, through really, as Alex said, this role of researchers, journalists, to inform others about how these systems are built and take action. But I think that action is not only about the people or the communities impacted by these systems. Of course, that's super important. And that is what Alex was just naming. But also, I think it is important to foster and to help foster, action within the communities of workers who are building these systems. I think that can be incredibly powerful. So the Tech Workers Coalition and other organizations like Turkopticon, where workers organize and even unionize, and they fight not only for better working conditions, but also for better data, for better systems, for systems that are more just and that are less harmful. And I think like these two poles, in a way, the organization of the people who are impacted by the systems and the organization of the workers who are creating these systems, and also the dialogue between those, also should be fostered in a way, or should be enabled in a way, because I think that could be incredibly powerful.
Speaking very generally, I feel like any meaningful accountability to me has to involve redistribution of wealth and resources, because I think for any of this to be possible, people need money to exist and to organize. And if we want to be able to set the terms of these discussions and set the terms of the kind of technologies that we actually want to build, people need money and resources and institutional power. And so I think when sort of dreaming about the kinds of accountability systems that we could put in place for corporations or people who do harm with technology, I feel like thinking about resource allocation is really the crux of it for me. But yeah, also everything that Alex and Mila said, I think is spot on.
The tech and academic sectors share many similar inequitable labor and knowledge production practices, but both have pockets of organized resistance, often led by those in the most marginalized positions.
I cut my teeth in the academic labor movement, in the graduate student worker movement, you know, in the early 2010s. And that's where I found a lot of parallels in the sort of workers in the tech industry and the same challenges. Because I think a lot of tech workers think of themselves as, you know, maybe toiling for a bit, but then they're going to get a huge term sheet from a VC and they're going to get rich. And then, you know, many academics kind of think of themselves the same way. They're like, I'm going to study for a little bit and then I'm going to get tenure and then I'm going to strike it rich. And that's just becoming less and less realistic. Here in California, for instance, I'm part of the lecturers unit at the University of California system, and the union there and the lecturers pushed back and organized and approved a strike vote at 96%. threatened a strike and actually was able to extract some pretty good concessions from the University of California system. We can think about the Maple Spring in Quebec, in which the state threatened to raise fees on students, and 300,000 students went on strike over a 9-month period. And unfortunately, was not able to stop that fee raise, but I think they decreased it a little bit. And so these movements do exist, probably not at the highest levels, at the levels of tenured faculty, because they are the most secure. But they're definitely happening when it comes with contingent faculty and graduate students and undergrad students who are paying more and more fees and getting into more and more debt. So I think any kind of challenge to the gatekeeping and of knowledge production, any these challenges are definitely going to come from below. You know, they're going to come from people who are already marginalized in this system and this hierarchy.
Maybe I can add that, first of all, that yeah, these efforts should exist. And I do agree with Alex that if they are to exist or if they already exist, this probably comes from below and not from the tenured white professor who is securing their position. What I can say is that the institutional context does a lot, and it shapes a lot how these efforts are carried out and what kind of efforts are possible in a way, and also the question about who is in an authority position or how, you know, we produce knowledge and who is going to be recognized as, yeah, legitimate knowledge producer. So I think that that's a lot. Like, for example, to me, it's really very much of an opposite example of seeing my institution in Germany and working for there. And I'm happy this is going to be heard mostly in the US, not in Germany, and not by my bosses and at my institution in Germany. But really, it's really very limited what one can do when the institution doesn't go along. And this is, I think, the novelty of what there is and what we are building together here. We are required to hold ourselves accountable. This is nothing that I have seen somewhere else, and I'm really happy it exists.
To learn more about the work of DARE, please visit their website at www.dare-institute.org. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you're provoked by what you heard today, we invite you to join us at the Knowledge Equity Lab. Together, we can fundamentally reimagine knowledge systems and build healthier relationships and communities of care that promote and enact equity at multiple levels. Please visit our website, sign up for our mailing list, follow us on social media, and send us a message to get involved.